Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Lance Hammer. He is the writer and director of the film Ballast, which is premiering at the Center for Contemporary Arts here in Santa Fe as part of the African Effect Film Festival. Right now, I'd like to welcome Thomas and Karen Fitzsimmons. Thomas is a poet and Karen is an artist. Their latest collaboration is the book In the Cemetery There Are Lovers. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you've been working this way for a long time. You write poems, you make the artworks, and they go together. How did you start doing that?
That was a long time ago, like 30 years ago, yeah.
How did we start? Well, there was a book of poetry, and I think the first one that I did was Japanese poetry in translation. And they needed some a cover and some illustrations. There was a collection of about five different poets. And that's what got me started, was reading poetry from Japanese modern poets, very, very different than our modern American poetry. And it just got really, I really got really inspired by it, because it took me to very different places in my head. And then I could respond not only to the English translation, but to the sound of the Japanese words. The rhythm and just the sound of it takes me to places. It's like dancing, and music. The poetry is music. And then when Thomas and I started working together on his poems, I took that same sensibility of listening to his poems as he would read them, hearing the rhythm, as well as getting into the images.
So how did you actually start making Oriental ink paintings, mm-hmm. they're called. Obviously, Japanese,
yes.
or maybe other countries as well, influenced. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the process, but I mean, were you trained this way by a Japanese teacher or something?
Yes. Thomas was in Japan, and I went to Japan specifically to be with him. And while there, the first time, which was back in, early 70s, I began studying with a Japanese teacher, and I started learning sumi-ei. It was all around me in Japan, and I got very inspired by it and loved the possibilities of working just in black and white and shades of gray on this very special paper.
Yeah. It seems that the artworks are, to some extent, abstract and to some extent organic forms that you can relate to plants and nature scenes and so on.
I think particularly in this book that's true. Thomas's poems in this book are somewhat a little more abstract, and I take the central meaning of the poems and kind of let my mind run with them.
Poem comes first.
The poem comes first in this case, yeah.
And so in a way you could call them illustrations, although that might not be the right word.
You could, because in this book particularly, Thomas wrote all the poems first, and then I would take a couple of them and read them, and then read them three or four times, and then I just shut the book and go away. And then some time later I would get an idea started. And sometimes it was just one central image, and sometimes it was more of a combination of rhythm and image. So you get this abstract, sometimes it's swirly, sometimes it's very static, and sometimes angular kind of response.
So the poems themselves, a lot of them are in a way little observed scenes in life. Is it always you, Thomas Fitzsimmons, the observer? Are you writing from the point of view of other characters?
Well, there's a whole bunch of characters inside my head, I guess. And that determines the tone of the poem, but fundamentally it's always me. I'm not trying to do a narrative or create characters. I'm In this book especially, I'm responding to the outside social world more. The last few books, the last one was a celebration of New Mexico in haiku. One before that was a celebration of Karen and I in haiku. And before that, there were... I've done 16 books alone. Karen and I have done 12 besides that. And sometimes I write poems to her paintings. That's happened in 2 books. But most of the time it goes the other way.
Would you like to, so that people can get a sense of the poetry, read one of your poems?
Sure.
We're talking to Thomas and Karen Fitzsimmons. Their newest book, their collaboration, is called In the Cemetery There Are Lovers.
This book starts in the cemetery, which is simply the surrounding world that we have managed to cause so much death in. And then it goes to a more abstract look at the social things, the double talk we indulge in that allows us to do that without paying attention to it. Then it comes to the only solution we've found to living in such a world, which is ourselves, each other. The first section is called In the Cemetery, the Cemetery, and divided into the town and the village. I'll read the town. We follow each blind street, not knowing where it goes, knowing we will know when we get there. Step over gutters of red wreath water, knowing where it comes from, knowing we must not go there. We have no place to hide. We know we'll be on time, where the streets all come together on a dime we've spent before. The mortars ring the hours. We follow each our shadow around another corner to where the ravens clean the bones, and from the sewers bloom the silken heads of those who sent us.
So I read this poem. It's the first one in the book. I read it from beginning to end, and I thought, what the heck are the silken heads of those who sent us?
Politicians.
Ah.
Who start wars and send young men to war.
Silken, huh?
Well, they take care of their hair.
So, when you say we follow each blind street, are you talking the we of the couple, the two of you, or are you talking about the collective we?
No, I'm talking about the soldiers in this case. I was in World War II through the whole war, and I empathize with what these boys go through, girls now too. So the we is them, but I'm in them. I'm with them in my mind, my heart, somewhere.
So it is one of those characters that is you, but is also somebody else.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. You're alluding to political themes. They're not always directly expressed. Why use poetry to talk about politics rather than, say, manifesto?
Well, if you write manifestos of prose, you're trying to move people to a particular action or belief, which is great, and I did that for many, many years on the New Republic. But what I'm trying to do is suggest to people that they... Most of this is very indirect stuff, and some of it is kind of difficult. The relationships between the images and the other words are not exactly clear. You have to bring something to it. You have to create along with the poem. And this is a much more accessible one than some of the others. The purpose of that is to... Prose has taught us to follow a chain of thought, and that sees something proven, the predicate is proven correct about the subject. The predicate claims something about the subject, and we want to convince the reader that that's true or acceptable. Poetry is a nudge. Have you got something floating around in you that you haven't put together yet, and will it help you access the significance, not the meaning, but the significance of these lines and of the poem? And if that happens, then the reader has done a creative act, and that's a whole lot better than just simply accepting or rejecting an argument, it seems to me. I prefer it.
You just said the significance, not the meaning. What's the distinction?
A meaning is essentially prose. It says that this means that, or this is that, or this is, you know, subsumed in that. Significance is what it, if you like, what it means to you, how it generates or bubbles around inside your own being.
Significance has sign in it.
Yeah. And most meaning is dependent on sign, but we use the word significance a little differently. It suggests something about importance, power, to make you feel, you know. That's a significant event. It doesn't exactly mean the same as that's a meaningful event.
Would you like to read another poem?
Sure.
I think it's always nice to read aloud. I read some of these aloud just to try to help me understand them and read them to a friend who was sitting there so we could talk about them. And it's a very different experience than reading them on the page, obviously.
Well, I think that poetry is a voice art, and the characters on the page are very much like musical notes on a score. You have to change the note or the notation into the sound to really get the whole thing, for the significance to come across. So I know it's become very conventional in our culture to think of poetry as a page art, and it leads to a great deal of cleverness on the page.
Is that right? I thought we were sort of in an era of spoken word and performance and all of that.
It's coming back, yeah. But I remember years ago when I first wrote performance poems, people were very upset about it. They wanted to see the poem on the page. I don't know quite why. I guess they were checking up if I was cheating with my voice or something, whatever that might mean.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why I get off in his poems so well, because when he reads them or I read them aloud, I mean, it's part of the punctuation and the one word following the other with a gap. That's what makes the rhythm. That's what makes part of the significance for me. You're going to read again.
This is one from the village section, and it starts to move out into less focus on actual combat or killing or to a reality in the surround. At the far end of the village, roses, purple mountains just above. At the water basin, a songbird scans, danger all around. On the path, a young rattlesnake coils. It is only able to eat small things. It will kill anything.
You know, I was wondering in this, that section of poems called The Villages, are they all separate poems or are they meant to be read as one? Each one of them has one of Karen's drawings next to it.
I haven't titled any of these poems so that they can be read as a long poem, but also as an individual part, you know. The whole book is essentially thought of as a whole poem, in my mind. That's the way I do books.
Let's go back to an earlier part of your life. You were, as you just mentioned, with the New Republic for 4 years. What did you do with that publication?
I started out as a writer, became a writer and an editor. I covered the political scene in Washington. In those days, the press corps was pretty small and not very fancy, and I covered the White House, the Senate, the State Department, the Pentagon, mostly by telephone. You know, we didn't have time to run around town all that much. The big papers, the weeklies, the dailies had a big staff. But we were a weekly. And essentially, I wrote essays. We were called, and I guess still called, a magazine of opinion. We didn't pretend to what is now pretended to objectivity. I'm not quite sure I know what that means. So I wrote essays, mostly denouncing.
What were some of the things you were denouncing?
Well, McCarthy was my constant concern. I was there from about 53 to 57, somewhere in
were
there.
Were you actually there during the demise of McCarthy?
Yeah, I like to think I played a part in that.
Is that right? Tell us, say more about that.
Well, McCarthy had a trick. McCarthy was a very attractive Irish drinker, and he hung out with reporters a lot, and we all enjoyed him.
That's not an oxymoron, attractive Irish drinker?
No,
anyway,
you know, charming drunks are all over the place. He caught on to what Nixon had done when Nixon was on the House Un-American Activities Committee, I think it was. And he realized what a powerful club it was to go beating people as communists and red travelers. Nixon had won his seat in the House by calling Helen Gahagan Douglas, who was a great congresswoman from Los Angeles, a fellow traveler. I think he invented that phrase. So McCarthy started doing this, and he would do it just before the... In those days, I think it was the newspaper of the evening that everybody really read. The morning papers didn't matter much. And he would do this just before the deadline. The accusations, startling accusations, there were thousands of communists in the armed forces, hundreds in the State Department, would get printed, and then you couldn't catch up with it. You could deny that the next morning, but nobody paid any attention. So some of us decided the only way to deal with this man was to make fun of him, because he really was off the wall about so many things. So the cartoons, I don't remember names very well anymore, but the cartoonist who did Pogo introduced a McCarthy character, and a two-gun carrying character. Another columnist, cartoonist on the Washington Post, whose name I can't remember, did very good cartoons. I wrote pieces every week almost on McCarthy, pointing out this or that.
And so, I mean, you pointed things out making fun of him. You were part of this brigade of cartoonists. And
I had the great pleasure of seeing him put down by the Senate committee that finally, and that goes on and on and on. There was no end to politics. It's always essentially the same fight.
Well, how would you characterize that same fight?
People wanting more power, finding ways to get it and keep it, lying about it. That's a lot of these poems touch on that in a glancing way. It's something that happens to people who get into significant power. It's very hard to imagine not having it, because you can manipulate not only other people but events, the whole symbolism of the society. Look what happened in the last 8 years, you know. We're suddenly going over and killing Iraqis is God's work. Because we lost 3,000 people, which is terrible, but the Iraqis didn't do that. We couldn't stand being hurt without hurting somebody back. And having the power to do that is very, very inebriating, and it's hard to give up.
So you were in Washington covering Washington politics in various manifestations for the New Republic. So you were deeply in it, you were looking at that political scene. How is it, if it is, different from the political scene that we find ourselves in a half a century later?
The political scene now is a lot smoother, more sophisticated. The lies are more intricate, and they are orchestrated in a much more effective way. We didn't have television. This is under the Eisenhower administration. I don't think we had television.
Yeah, you had television, but maybe you weren't watching it.
Probably not.
Wasn't as big a deal.
You're watching. Everyone was watching I Love Lucy, I believe, in that time.
I never saw that. Yeah. Well, anyway, but it wasn't a major. I don't believe people were still getting their stuff from radio and print. Important stuff and cartoons. Cartoons were very important. I think cartoons are just fantastic. And there was always this business of taking a stand in whatever issue that you were good and the others were bad. It was never here as a, you know, issue, how do we solve this problem? Was my solution makes me a good person, your solution makes you a bad person.
That sounds familiar.
I finally got so sick of it, I quit. I wanted to do something else entirely. So
when you're a poet, you're not going to have, presumably, the readership, or it's unlikely that you'll have the readership that you have when you're writing for a national weekly. What is it like for you to be expressing yourself in this way?
Well, I got very tired of that scene. There was a correlatory scene that in my literary, I was writing poetry at the time, publishing in journals and little magazines. And this took me frequently to New York to go to the parties. You have to go to certain parties to advance your career in literature in this country. And after the initial excitement of those very good parties, you get really I got really tired of all that stuff. And so the dimension, very small as it was, of fame that I had on the New Republic became a real hindrance to being a flexible poet or person, and I got the hell out. I've never wanted it again. I had it a little bit of again when I started teaching at university, because students could get very enthusiastic about you, but you can dodge that a whole lot better.
Thomas Fitzsimmons and Karen Fitzsimmons are respectively a poet and artist. Their latest collaboration is called In the Cemetery, There Are Lovers. I want to thank you both so much for joining us here on KSFR.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you very much. Yes.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. We'll be talking about the film Ballast in just a couple of moments.